What's the magic word? We sometimes tell our kids that please is a magic word, and folktales are full of words like abracadabra or open sesame that have surprising powers. But it turns out that even some of the ordinary words we use in everyday conversation can perform magical feats, not just informing, but influencing, entertaining, and connecting. Knowing what those words are and how to use them is the subject of the new book, Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way by Jonah Berger. Jonah is a Wharton School professor and a best-selling author, and he joins us now to share five of his big ideas.
Hi, this is Jonah Berger, and I'm here to talk to you about my new book, Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way. I don't have to tell you that almost everything we do involves words. From the emails and PowerPoints that we write, to the phone calls and pitch meetings that we pull together, we talk to others face-to-face and over written communication, and words are how we persuade, communicate, and connect. They're how leaders lead, salespeople sell, and parents parent. They're how teachers teach, policymakers govern, and doctors explain. In fact, even our private thoughts rely on language. But while we sort of spend a lot of time using language, we rarely think about the specific language that we use. Sure, we might think a lot about the ideas we want to communicate. When we make a presentation, for example, what's the main thrust of what we want to get across? But we often think a lot less about the particular words we use when we communicate those ideas. But unfortunately, that's a mistake, because subtle shifts in the words we use can have a big effect on our actual impact. Take something like trying to persuade others. It turns out that adding one word to a sentence can increase the likelihood that others take our request by about 50%. Or think about the recommendations that we make. Research that my colleagues and I have done looking at hundreds of thousands of online reviews in a variety of different contexts shows that something as simple as saying I recommend product or service rather than saying I like that product or service leads other people to be about a third more likely to take your recommendation. And in contexts as diverse as the words we use in writing email and the language we use when applying for a loan, words reveal exciting things about the people that produce them. Research, for example, shows that how similar your language is to your colleagues at the office can have an important prediction on whether you get promoted or get let go from the company. And research on the language we use in loan applications shows that we can predict whether someone's going to pay back that loan or whether they're going to default based just on the words they use in their application alone. It's clear that certain words are more impactful than others. They're better at changing minds, engaging audiences, and driving action. And so the key question is, well, what are these magic words and how can we take advantage of their power? In Magic Words, I talk about six key types of words, six key types of language that we can use to increase our impact. And to help it make it be easier to remember what those words are, I put them in a framework, and it's the SPEACS framework. That's S-P-E-A-C-C. I know it should end in a K, but as somebody pointed out, it's always hard to find a K in Scrabble, and the same thing was true here. The S is for the language of similarity and difference. The P is for the language of posing questions. The E is for the language of emotion. The A is the language of agency and identity. One of the C's is for the language of confidence, and the second C is for the language of concreteness. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go through all the ideas here, but I'll give a couple of tips or key takeaways about how to apply language. Take something as simple as trying to persuade others. Often we're trying to get someone to do something. We may be asking them to help with a particular thing, or if we're a nonprofit, we may want to get them to turn out to vote. Often when we do that, we ask in a particular way. We use a verb like help or vote to ask people to do that thing. But it turns out that a subtle shift in language, in fact, just adding one or even two letters to the end of those words, can have a big impact on whether or not we're successful. A number of years ago, a study was done at Stanford University where they asked kids in an elementary school classroom to help clean up. There was a mess on the floor, and they asked some of the kids, they said, can you help clean up, as we often might ask for help. But for the other half of the kids, they did something slightly different. Rather than asking for help, they asked those kids to be a helper. Now, the difference between help and helper is infinitesimally small. It's only two letters. Yet asking people to be a helper rather than help led to about a 30% increase in the percentage of kids who helped clean up. And it's not just kids in classrooms. Recent works find the same thing happens with adults and more consequential behavior. They looked at voting, for example, and asked some people to vote, as we often do. And for a second set of people, they asked them to be a voter. And they found that subtle shift, in this case, just one extra letter, turning vote into voter, led people to be about 15% more likely to vote. And the reason why is simple. We all know that we should do things like help and vote, but we're pretty busy. We don't have the time. Yet what we really care about is feeling like we hold desired identities. We want to see ourselves positively. We want to see ourselves as smart and interesting and attractive and athletic. And so we engage in actions that support those ideas. We want to see ourselves as athletic. We need to run every so often. And so if actions give us an opportunity to hold desired identities, we're more likely to take those actions. Sure, voting, yeah, I know I should vote, but I just don't have the time. But wait, be a voter, hold that desirable identity. Well, that's something I want to do. And if voting is an opportunity to show myself and others that I am a voter, I'm more likely to do it. Same thing with helping, right? Kids know that they should help, but maybe they don't want to. But being a helper is a desirable identity. And so if helping is a way to claim that desired identity, they're more likely to do it. In fact, the same thing also holds in the negative direction. Losing is bad, but being a loser is even worse. Cheating is sure bad, but being a cheater is even worse. And so research shows that when cheating would make you a cheater, cheating on a test would make you a cheater, people are less likely to do it because they don't want to engage in an action that would lead them to show that undesirable identity. This even holds true for how we describe ourselves. Imagine I told you about two people. I told you about one person who runs and the other person who is a runner. If I asked you which of those two people runs more often, you'd probably say, well, the person who is a runner, right? Because identities seem like more stable things. Sure, if someone runs, they go running once in a while, but if they are a runner, it seems much more persistent. And so by calling ourselves, rather than just saying I run, saying I am a runner, it makes it seem like a more stable trait, and that may make us more likely to engage in that action in the future. Similarly, it affects how other people perceive us, right? Rather than saying you're hardworking, saying you're a hard worker makes it seem more like a persistent characteristic. Rather than saying you're creative, saying you're a creator makes it seem like an identity and a bigger part of who you are. And so by turning actions into identities, we can make things seem more stable and persistent and shape how we're perceived. That's one example from the chapter about the language of agency and identity. But another chapter I like a lot is the language of questions, right? How can we ask better questions and pose better questions? And one key insight from that chapter is about asking for advice. Often, whether at home or at the office, we might be stuck on a tough problem. We're trying to solve something or do something, and it's difficult. We can't figure it out. And so sometimes we think about asking for advice. We think we might ask a peer or a colleague who might know more than we do, but we're often reticent to do that. Why? Because first, we don't know if they'll be able to help us. Second, they might be busy. And third, even worse, we're worried they might think less of us. We ask them for advice. It looks like we don't know what we're doing. And so they'll think we're less competent and less knowledgeable. But it turns out that intuition is actually incorrect because some researchers at Harvard and Wharton did a very nice paper where they looked at asking for advice. And they had people have a variety of different types of interactions. Sometimes people asked for advice, sometimes they didn't. And they found that asking for advice doesn't actually make us look worse. And it doesn't actually change how we look. It actually makes us look better. Asking for advice makes us look smarter and more competent, not less. And the reason why, very simply, is that people are egocentric. All of us love to think that we give good advice. All of us love to think we're smart and have good thoughts. And so when someone else comes up to us and asks us for our advice, we think, wow, they must be pretty smart because of all the people they could have asked, they asked us. And so what this suggests is, look, when you have a tough problem, ask for advice. Not only will that give you the information that you need to make a better decision or solve your problem, but it'll also make you look better as a result. Another key insight from the book is around the language of confidence. And we all know people in our lives that are particularly charismatic, right? When they open their mouths, everyone stops to listen. But one question is why? Why are certain individuals so charismatic? And if you look across folks, you often see one characteristic in common. And I don't want to get into politics, but if you listen to Donald Trump's speeches, you'll notice he has this in spades. And I recognize people feel differently about Donald Trump, but whether you like him or not, it's hard to disagree that he's done a great job of selling his ideas. He's mobilized millions of people to believe and support the things he wants to do. And so whether you agree with him or not, one question is why? Why is he so successful? And if you look at his speeches, you'll notice something interesting. When he first ran for office, for example, made his first presidential run, he made a speech saying something like, you know, if I'm elected, I'll build a great wall and I'll build it very cheaply. And, you know, we don't have victories in the United States anymore. We used to, but we don't have them anymore. In trade deals with China, for example, you know, we're behind. And I beat China all the time. When this speech came out, some people, noted that it was overly simplistic or said it was full of bluster or empty. And yet, a year later, he was elected president. And so even if you don't like his ideas or the way he talks, some things he's doing is working. What is it? Well, if you look at Trump, he does the same thing that a lot of charismatic leaders do. Look at great salespeople, look at startup founders like an Elon Musk or a Steve Jobs, look at gurus. They all do the same thing, which is they all speak with a great deal of certainty. They say things are definitely true. This will certainly work. Everyone agrees. The answer is obvious. It's abundantly clear. They speak with a great deal of certainty. And not surprisingly, certainty is often quite persuasive. Research on financial advisors, for example, shows that people are more likely to pick advisors that seem more certain, even though those advisors aren't right more often, and in some cases may be overconfident. People are more likely to pick certain financial advisors because if an advisor's particularly certain or someone's particularly certain in general, if they seem so certain about what they're saying, it's hard not to believe what they're saying could be correct. But contrast that with what most of us do most of the time. I'm an academic. I'm guilty of this myself. But when I work with consulting clients, they'll often say something like, what do you think of this strategy? And I'll say, well, it might work. You know, it seems like a good idea. I think this is the best course of action. If you notice what I'm doing, I'm hedging my words, saying things like I think, possibly, probably, seems, might. And all of us hedge all the time. It's a common verbal tick we use. But unfortunately, hedging often undermines our impact. Because by hedging, we show the audience that we're not so confident, and it makes what we say less persuasive. People are less likely to follow our advice, to do what we're suggesting when we hedge because we seem less confident. And so sometimes we need to ditch the hedges, right? Certainly, if there's a case where there's a great deal of uncertainty, maybe we want to communicate uncertainty. But if our goal is to persuade others, let's not hedge too much. Let's only use hedges when we mean to. And second, beyond ditching the hedges, we need to own the uncertainty. Right? Notice the difference between saying something like, I'm not sure if that's going to work, versus I think this is a great strategy, but to make it work, three things need to happen. In that second version, I'm making it clear that I'm still not sure the strategy is going to work, but if we can make these three things happen, the strategy will be a great idea. And so own the uncertainty. Make it clear what you're certain about and what you're uncertain about, and people will be more likely to listen. One last quick takeaway that I find fascinating is the language of creativity. Often when we're stuck on something, we don't know what to do, we're trying to figure out the right answer. Being creative is really hard. It's hard to think outside the box and come up with new ideas. But research finds, again, that a subtle shift, switching one word out, can actually make us much more creative and help us come up with better solutions. Because often when we think about trying to solve a problem or we're stuck in a bind, we often think about what we should do. Given the situation I'm in, what should I do? What is the right course of action? And while shoulds are useful in some ways, they can be quite restricting. They focus us on only thinking about maybe one or two right answers, and they narrow us to other possibilities. But research shows that rather than think about what we should do, if we instead think about what we could do instead, we're much more likely to come up with creative solutions. Research finds that asking people to think about what they could do leads them to think outside the box, think a little bit more broadly. And even if they don't end up implementing one of those things that they came up with, it helps them reach a better solution in the end. And so think in coulds rather than shoulds. It'll help you be better problem solver and more creative. Overall, these are just a few of the tips from my new book, Magic Words. Language is so exciting, and we use it all the time. We are all writers. We may not write books or essays or articles in the newspapers, but we write emails and PowerPoint presentations and Word documents. We are all speakers. We may not get up on stage and do keynotes for millions of people, but we speak all the time. We speak in meetings, we speak to our spouse, we speak to our children. All of these things involve language. And if we understand the power of magic words and how to use them and why they have such a great impact, we can increase our own impact as well.
Thank you, Jonah. That was Jonah Berger with 5 big ideas from Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way. You might also like our book bite for Jonah's previous book, The Catalyst, How to Change Anyone's Mind. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.